Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, October 21st, welcome, 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 friends, to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And my name is Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
October 1985, 40 years ago, the American Cancer Society launched a week-long effort to raise awareness about breast cancer. They promoted screenings and mammograms. Fast forward 4 decades, and there's been so much movement, so many advances when it comes to breast cancer treatment, so much new research, and so many lives saved. But more and more Americans are being diagnosed with breast cancer. There's also an issue because people are being diagnosed younger and younger. Today, though, 9 out of 10 people diagnosed with breast cancer will survive at least 5 years, and there is a new discovery out of Penn on how to detect and kill dormant cancer sleeper cells. And we have one of the researchers who's involved in that work who will spend the hour with us. So we're going to talk about a lot of things, and we'd love to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere. Tell us your breast cancer story if you or someone engaged in that battle. Also, how have you seen breast cancer treatment and awareness shift over the years? The number to call is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, please share the video, but also leave your comments in the chat.
We take it for granted sometimes.
Yeah.
Living in Philadelphia with all the great research facilities, that some of the people who know the most these illnesses live right here. Mm-hmm. And are accessible to us and can answer our questions. So I'm looking forward to today's conversation. Again, the number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. But first, Cherry, a trio of local news stories, and you are going to start us off.
Yes, 2 million Pennsylvanians will not receive SNAP or low-income food assistance payments in November due to the federal government shutdown. The Shapiro administration has issued a warning to families, and a lot of the nonprofit food pantries and organizations that help fight food insecurity, they are getting nervous because this could have a huge impact across the state. Governor Josh Shapiro spoke about this on Monday, but what makes this story even more interesting is the politics, because the Shapiro administration, they're taking a page out of the Trump handbook by posting a statement on the PA.gov website, specifically blaming his political opposition in Washington. The site reads in part, because Republicans in Washington, D.C. failed to pass a federal budget, causing the federal government shutdown, November 2025 SNAP benefits cannot be paid.
So because Republicans is the key phrase.
Yes.
There. Because Republicans.
Yeah. He's blaming Republicans there. And of course, the Pennsylvania GOP, they got a little bit upset by this blame game. And they posted on X that, quote, taxpayer funded agency should never be used for partisan spin, period, they say. And they go on to say Shady Shapiro owes Pennsylvanians an apology. So there's a little bit of back and forth.
Yeah.
But the real story to me is that millions of Pennsylvanians will not get food assistance in November, and it is related to the shutdown. And of course, all of this comes as we have our own state budget impasse.
Right. And you mentioned that this was out of the Trump playbook, because when the government shut down initially, there were all sorts of notices posted on official government websites.
Oh, yeah. Blaming Democrats.
Blaming Democrats for the shutdown. Also, automatic email replies from bureaucrats, from federal employees, blaming Democrats for the shutdown, even though the employees in some of those cases didn't even authorize those as their own, you know, automatic email replies. That I would imagine, that I would argue is a step further than putting something on a website. Mm-hmm. But it is, of course, still all in the same area of using the government to point the arrow at your opponent and say, this is the guy that messed up.
Yeah.
And that feels like a very slippery slope.
And by the way, the Department of Human Services, they issued a statement to WGAL defending what they wrote. And they said, look, the Republicans control the U.S. Senate, House, and White House and failed to pass the budget, which led to the shutdown. So they're doubling down.
Also, Shady Shapiro. Hadn't heard that nickname before. I guess that's a new one.
I don't know.
Story number two. Philadelphia's anti-bag advocates are on the precipice of a big win, Cherry. A bill making its way through Philadelphia City Council would require supermarket stores and corner shops to charge customers 10 cents for every paper bag used. This is on top of the city's ban straight-out ban on single-use plastic bags, which took effect in 2021. Mm. The paper bag fee has majority support on council, but it's unclear if Mayor Parker will actually sign the bill. Her administration has expressed some skepticism, arguing this might penalize small businesses and low-income shoppers. Proponents, however, say this is a necessary move to reduce waste and that businesses essentially already pass along the cost of paper bags to customers, so not that big an effect there. Of note, Mayor Kenney declined to sign similar legislation about paper bags in 2023.
So I'll say this. Many of the stores like Aldi, CVS, they already charge a fee. And mind you, the paper bags that they offer you these days, they're horrible. Okay.
Wait.
I forgot my reusable bag.
You
I got a
paper
bag.
Paper bags have gotten worse?
Yes. The sucker ripped five seconds after I bought the bag.
I didn't even notice this. I should be paying attention.
And I almost dropped everything. And I recently saw a woman try to load paper bags in her trunk. Apples went rolling down the street. Lesson learned. Bring your own bag.
Yeah. You got to.
Because that little 10 cents is not worth it. Those bags are trash. They really are trash. I'm sorry. I know this is a serious, real news story, but.
Speaking of trash, a city commission study estimated in the ban's first year, the plastic bag ban's first year, it prevented over 200 million plastic bags from being used in the city. However, it tripled the percentage of customers using paper bags, and the paper bags are actually more energy intensive to make. Now, you can reuse them or recycle them, mm-hmm. so there is some benefit downstream, but it's interesting to see that, you know, a well-intentioned policy has caused this other effect, and now a new policy is trying to address that effect. And, you know, lawmaking is a messy business, a difficult business, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we got to get off the sauce of the bags. We got to get off the bags, man.
Do you have a nice little roster, a little store of the reusables?
I do, but I've forgotten them because, you know, you take them in the house.
Absolutely.
You're taking them
every
in the
time.
House. And then you get there and you're like, I don't have a bag.
Absolutely.
And then you end up having
You one of the reusable bags at the store now.
And then it rips and all your apples go down the street.
I have to say, at WHYY, I feel like we were kind of ahead of the curve on bags, like tote bags and all that stuff. Public radio's been there. So get on board with the bag revolution, folks. Okay, story number three. Cherry, there are nine movies in the Rocky franchise.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of them.
But if that wasn't enough, get ready for a movie about how the first Rocky movie got made.
Say what?
I am not kidding you, Cherry Gregg. The film is called I Play Rocky. It tells the story of how Sylvester Stallone got the original Rocky movie made. If you don't know, it actually is a pretty incredible bet-on-yourself Hollywood story. Stallone was nearing 30 at the time. He was a struggling actor. He wrote the script for Rocky and then insisted that he play the title role, even though he didn't have much cachet at that point. The big studio said, Sylvester, buddy, Sly, you're nuts. He made the movie independently. Of course, went on to win an Oscar, become an iconic movie. Just this week, by the way, we got some early pictures of Anthony Ippolito playing Stallone in that upcoming movie. Don't believe it has a release date yet. And to clarify, this is not a documentary. This is a major motion picture about the making of a motion picture, and Stallone himself was not involved in the film. So anyways, more Rocky.
By the way, Ippolito kind of looks like a young Stallone.
It is eerie.
And they nailed the dusty gray sweatsuit that Rocky became known for. I mean, that dusty gray looks on point. And I mean, for a guy who was at 29, basically unknown, had a partially paralyzed face and a speech impediment.
Yeah.
Sylvester Stallone.
It made it work. Yeah.
I mean, that was the box office hit that year when Rocky came out. He killed it.
He did. He had conviction. I'll give him that. And it is a pretty amazing story. I'm a little skeptical, I guess, of a movie about the making of a movie.
Because I'm
not a big film guy in general, so it's a lot to get me to go to a movie, and then I don't really care about how movies got made. Mm-hmm. So for me, I eye this with a bit of skepticism, but who knows? Maybe just like Rocky, it'll be a breakthrough hit that we never saw coming.
But you know what? I don't know if I'll go to the movies to see it, but when it comes on Amazon Prime,
yeah, you'll be there.
I'm going to watch it with some popcorn. I will be watching it.
With a big stack of your reusable bags right next to you. Yeah.
Right. I know that's right.
By the way, the big Bruce Springsteen biopic starring Jeremy Allen White comes out on Friday. So a big week for entertainment icons in their 70s with ties to the Philadelphia area.
Look at you tying it all together.
I love to tie it all together.
You do the loop so well, Avi.
I'm a looper. Aaron. What can I say? I'm a looper. Okay, so shifting tone now and shifting topic. coming up
yeah.
after this break. The show today is all about breast cancer and breast cancer research and what we're learning about this deadly disease. We've come a long way
yeah.
from the mid-1980s.
That's when breast cancer awareness first launched, if you yep. didn't know.
But we still have a long way to go.
Yeah.
We've got a great expert lined up. We want to hear from you. We want to know about your personal experience with breast cancer, whether it's yourself, a family member. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. Or if you're on YouTube or Facebook, you can drop a comment in the chat. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here at WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman, Aaron. National Breast Cancer Awareness Month started back in 1985. In the 40 years since then, there's been a ton of progress. From 1989 to 2022, for instance, the overall breast cancer death rate fell by 44%, according to the American Cancer Society.
But there's still a long way to go. More Americans are getting diagnosed with breast cancer, and we'll explore why this hour. And we'll also talk about new groundbreaking treatments for a disease that kills more than 42,000 people in this country every single year.
Our guide this hour is someone at the cutting edge of breast cancer research. Dr. Angela DeMichel is co-leader of the breast cancer program at the Abramson Cancer Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. DeMichel, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes, and to you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us your breast cancer story. If you or someone you love has been through it, we want to hear from you. Also, how have you seen treatment change or awareness change? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop your comment in the chat.
I would love to start with your research, Dr. DeMichel, about these dormant cancer cells. How to detect them, and what role could play in treatment. So I want to take us all inside what you're working on right now and what promise you think it holds for cancer patients.
Well, thanks for asking. This is really an important area, I think, of research that's been underappreciated. And I really started as a breast cancer oncologist. I was sitting with patients in the office who had finished all of their treatment. You know, they are newly diagnosed, they have surgery, chemotherapy, radiation. We hear all about those treatments, and then all of a sudden it's over, and we say, hey, you know, we think you're cancer-free. And the patients would say to me, well, how do you know? How do you know the treatment worked? How do you know I don't still have any cancer cells? How do you know if it's going to come back? And, you know, just by sitting with patients and hearing this over and over, realizing there really was a gap. Mm-hmm. Around 10 years ago, you know, we started to learn, well, what is actually happening between the time a patient finishes their treatment and when they relapse? And when we talk about relapse, we mean cancer coming back someplace else in the body, still breast cancer, but these are breast cancer cells that have managed to leave the breast and travel to other parts of the body, like the lungs or the liver or the bones. So when we talk about relapse, we're talking about this development of metastatic breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because this can happen years to even decades after someone's been diagnosed. So you might hear that someone had breast cancer and they're, you know, disease-free and everything's great. And then years later, oh, my breast cancer's come back. Mm. Why is that? Well, now we know. We have much better understanding of what's happening. And what's happening is that there are these specialized cells that can leave the breast and travel in the bloodstream to places that are these special niches mm-hmm. where they can then go dormant. By that, we mean they essentially go to sleep. They hibernate. Sort of like you think about a bear hibernating in a cave over the winter. You know, they don't need any external food. They're not moving around. They're not doing anything. And then they wake up. And when these cells wake
sounds
up.
Sounds so mysterious.
Yeah. Well, but this really took an enormous effort in the laboratory by my research partner, Louis Chodosh, and others who developed mouse models to help us track these cells. Where did they go and what were they doing? How did they stay asleep? How do they wake up?
And what did you find?
And so it turns out that the cells really can just switch off. they stop dividing, they power down, and they use very specialized mechanisms to stay alive in that state, because most cancer cells don't like to not be dividing. Mm-hmm. But these cancer cells can do it. And so when Dr. Chodosh and others found how they did it, they could look at drugs that could go in and attack those mechanisms.
So these cells still have signifiers. You can still find them in the body. And then you can give this ostensibly cancer-free patient a treatment plan.
That's right. So the cells tend to pool within the bone marrow. So we can do what's called a bone marrow aspirate, where we put a hollow needle into the bone of the hip. We do it right in the office under local anesthesia and take out that sample of liquid bone marrow, filter it, and figure out whether or not the patient has these dormant cancer cells. And then if they have the cells, we have been doing clinical trials of the drugs that target these sleeper cells.
And some of these drugs had already existed. These aren't necessarily new drugs. You all are repurposing treatments that already existed. Is that correct?
That's right. You know, it turns out that drugs can do lots of different things. And one of the drugs that we're using was used for malaria and has been used for inflammatory conditions. Mm. But it turned out that it also blocked this really important pathway called autophagy. Autophagy is how cells use their own internal energy sources to stay alive. And so by giving this drug, we could interfere with that and essentially, you know, take away what was allowing these cells to survive.
So I know this is early still in the research, or it's still evolving, but how much could this change the likelihood of relapse for the average patient who's already been treated for breast cancer?
Well, as you said, it is still early, and we have two confirmatory trials going on. But I think that what's important here is that up to this point, we've done a great job taking care of all of the dividing cancer cells that we could see. But we got to sort of a limit, a ceiling, where, you know, beyond that point, we just are not curing many more patients. So this feels like sort of that last frontier. This is really has the potential to eliminate this last reservoir of cells that we just didn't know we were missing before. Now we can find them, and hopefully we can take care of them.
Mm. So you won't have that patient worried that the cancer is going to come back, and it could save a lot of lives. Because I want to talk about the relapse part, because I don't think a lot of people know this, that a lot of times when it does relapse, it's more aggressive. Why is that?
Well, it's something that we don't fully understand. But once the cancer has gotten the ability to travel to other parts of the body, those cells really function very differently. Mm. And despite having many, many new treatments that can control those cells, we don't have a treatment that can completely eliminate them when they reach that phase. So we are trying to just make sure we get every last cell before they get to that point where they're no longer curable.
Mm-hmm. Just expanding the conversation. So this research is fascinating. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, but you're also just reading what other people are doing, and you're in touch with other people in the oncology community. What else is out there right now that's kind of at the cutting edge of research that really excites you? Whether it's new treatments, new ways of thinking about breast cancer detection, what out there is like, you're like, well, I can't wait to see where this goes.
Well, I there's so much, right? Yeah. So it's even hard to pick something that, you know, that is the most exciting. I would say this whole area of monitoring women who've had breast cancer. Yeah. You know, we have over 3 million breast cancer survivors in this country. There are 15 million around the world. All of those women and men are worried about their breast cancer coming back, even if their risk is low. We've not had a way to monitor people proactively. There's another technology called circulating tumor DNA, or ctDNA, which is a way to pick up the cells after they've woken up, while they're in the bloodstream, hopefully get to them before they get to other parts of the body. Mm-hmm. So this technology, ctDNA, is probably the most exciting thing that's happened in cancer in general, but also specifically in breast cancer for a long time. What this represents is shedding of tumor DNA from tumor cells. We can pick it up in really minute amounts. And we also can understand what that DNA is telling us about the cancer.
Yeah.
So we can see the mutations. We can see what drugs we should give to target those mutations. Mm-hmm. This is going to make it possible to treat cancer before it gets to the point where it starts to give people symptoms or create problems with
or
organ
maybe
function.
Or maybe visible on a scan.
Correct.
I was reading about, maybe this is the same thing, but these types of blood tests they could do like almost in between when your scheduled scans would be to see like, is your cancer responding to treatment like more like in real time as opposed to waiting for, oh, we see you have a tumor or something suspicious on a scan. Is that something that's kind of bubbling up too?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So even in the, you know, moving out of the surveillance setting into the metastatic setting, these are great tools because before we would start a therapy and you'd have to wait 3 or 4 months, mm-hmm. right? That's also incredibly stressful.
Yeah.
Well, if we can get an early read on whether or not this treatment's going to work, number one, we can tell people it's working. That's great news. That, you know, makes you feel much better. And if it's not working, we won't waste 3 or 4 months
yeah.
on a drug that's not going to work, that's giving people side effects. We can move on. So I think this is another really important way to use this technology, as you said, in real time to understand what the cancer is doing.
Wow. By the way, I want to encourage you, our listeners, to participate in the conversation. Tell us your breast cancer story. How have you seen treatment? How have you seen awareness change? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, please share the video, but also leave your comments in the chat. I want to read this comment from Maida, who says, it has been 30 years since I was diagnosed. I am thankful to God for my health, and breast cancer taught me not to take my life for granted. Edie says, thanks. She thanks us for this show and says she has, quote, dear people in my life who are survivors and two who lost their lives as a result of breast cancer. And so, Dr. D. Michelle, I want to sort of zoom out a little bit and talk about, because we're, so, you know, 40 years since people started raising awareness, promoting mammograms, promoting screenings. I know you probably were not an oncologist 40 years ago, but just I know, and just, you know, you all are taught history. And so just, can you take us back? Just what was it like 40 years ago? Because I read that there had been stigma 50 years ago. People, it was the C word. You didn't even talk about breast cancer. And now we're at a place where we're getting even closer to a cure. Can you just kind of talk about some of the big breakthroughs you've seen?
It has really been amazing over the course of my career. And it's true, back in 85, I was in college. But, you know, I came into breast cancer at a time when we were finally coming out of the years of really disfiguring surgeries. This was, you know, something that people didn't talk about. There was a lot of fear, often nothing much that could be done. So people wouldn't come to medical attention until it was quite late in the game. The surgeries that were done were very difficult, very disfiguring. And so there was stigma. Then in the 80s and 90s, chemotherapy came along, radiation therapy came along. And suddenly it was possible to not do such aggressive surgery, to be able to use these other modalities to help eliminate the tumor cells. And then mammography, which was an enormous advance, because so many of the cancers that we diagnose now, we can't feel them, we can't see them. And it really is about finding it early. The earlier you find it, the more curable it is. And this is why we do want people to do this screening. It's so important.
And I don't think people really understand, if you know, you come up now and you take for granted that they're sending you a letter when you turn 40 or 39. They're like, hey, you're about to be 40. You need to get your screening. This was something that people had to advocate for, to have this paid for and included in your insurance and all those things, because this is, and so I want people to really, I think we don't remember that this wasn't always something that existed.
Yeah, it's true. You know, screening for cancer is a relatively modern phenomenon, but when you talked about how much things have improved, the drop in the mortality rate, a large part of that is simply finding the cancers earlier when they're more curable. And once that data became available to show that you could find them and you could cure them, and people would live longer and mortality rates would drop, it suddenly became really essential that we figure out a way to pay for it.
Mm. Yeah.
A couple of interesting comments here that are on a similar theme, mm-hmm. and talk about the new reality for folks like living with breast cancer, sort of surviving breast cancer and what it's like for them. Marianne says, I was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2016. What I've learned is that oncology world has not shifted quickly enough on how we're treated. And I don't mean pharmaceutical surgery or radiation. I mean, as a whole person with psychosocial needs. Mm. Decades ago, we weren't really living, were we? Thanks to the hard work of researchers, we are living now, but that means we have new needs. And Jessica also talks about a lack of mental health support for patients and families. Jessica's a breast cancer survivor, diagnosed 3 years ago at age 41, no family history, no symptoms. Jessica is also worried, by the way, about cuts to research funding by the Trump administration and misinformation online about breast cancer. But what was in common between those two comments, Jessica and Marianne's, was this idea that now that there's been this advance in treatment, they feel that there needs to be the second advance in, like, how do I live my life after this? I'm curious how you see that from your perch, Dr. DeMichelle.
Well, I fully agree that this is an area that we need to provide more support to patients to address. This is a really traumatic thing that happens to people, and it's not just breast cancer, but any cancer diagnosis. It is like getting struck by lightning. You know, one day your life's going along, and then suddenly you find out you have cancer. And even for, you know, these very curable cancers, and we're so happy about the advances that have been made, this is traumatic. It is life-changing. Yeah. It is life-changing forever for people, and we do need to help them to cope with this. Many people are living even with advanced cancer, and you might not even know it because our treatments no longer cause people to lose their hair or to look sick. People are working and traveling, raising their kids. Now, how do they deal with this? Yeah. They've got costs that are associated with this. They might not be feeling so great. They're trying to live their lives. And so more psychosocial support would be incredibly helpful here. There are support groups. There is help out there. Most major medical centers have cancer counseling services. You simply have to ask. And then there are wonderful other organizations like Living Beyond Breast Cancer that's located here in Philadelphia that provide support for patients. And they are very willing to reach out and provide that emotional support. Help with how do you explain this to your kids? Mm-hmm. How do you talk to your employer? You know, all of these issues that are really critical to just trying to live a life and fight your cancer at the same time.
Yeah. And by the way, we want to bring in a caller who is a breast cancer survivor. We have Robin from Chestnut Hill on the line. Robin, you're on Studio 2. Thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, by the way, Robin is a 15-year breast cancer survivor. She was diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic breast cancer back in 2008. Robin, tell us a little bit about your journey.
Okay. First of all, let me say how much I appreciate you, Cherry. The work that you do to raise awareness and support survivors truly makes a difference. When I was diagnosed back in 2008 with stage 4 triple negative breast cancer, I wasn't expected to live. But here I am today because of research. It is truly remarkable how far we've come. Over the past 40 years, we've seen incredible progress. Early detection has improved, treatments have become more targeted, and survival rates continue to increase.
Yeah, and what sort of, you've also been involved in raising awareness, and so tell us, what have you personally seen as cancer treatment and focuses and awareness has shifted?
Okay, first of all, I have to acknowledge one of the leading voices in that progress, Dr. DeMichelle. Who is one of the premier cancer researchers in the country. Her leadership and vision have been at the forefront of some of the most important advancements in cancer research. She is truly an inspiration to survivors like me. So although we've made great strides, we're not done yet. We still need a lot more diversity in clinical trials, more funding, and equal access to to care for everyone, no matter who they are or where they live. It is not just about a medical goal, it's a human one. Ending breast cancer isn't just about science. It's about equity, education, and compassion.
Yeah.
Everyone has a role to play.
Yeah.
Getting screened, supporting research, or just lifting someone up who is going through it.
Yeah.
And I'm living proof that research saves lives.
And Robin, as we wrap up, I got to just ask you, because you've been living with breast cancer all these years. And I mean, to look at you, I would never know that you had breast cancer. So what is it like living with it? Because metastatic breast cancer means you live with it for the rest of your life.
Being involved as a cancer research advocate gives me hope every day.
Yeah.
I see people surviving. And so I like to tell people that cancer eats stress for breakfast in the morning. So if you're stressing out about your cancer, it's not going to get better. And I think that we can create a future where cancer isn't a life sentence, but a story of survival and strength. Together, we can make sure that over the next 40 years, it's not just better treatments, but a better future where breast cancer no longer takes lives.
Yeah. Thank you so much. That's Robin from Chestnut Hill.
Thank you so much for having me, and have a blessed and wonderful day.
Thank you. Oh wait. Dr. DeMichel has something to say.
Yes.
I just wanted to say hi, Robin, because Robin and I know each other, and I have to just let everyone know, Robin is a patient advocate.
Yeah.
And so she has turned this experience into something that she's devoted her life to trying to help. And the fact that she and other advocates, they partner with us researchers mm-hmm. to make sure that the research we're doing is asking the right questions. It's communicating with patients in a way that they can understand, making sure that everything we do is safe for patients. This partnership is really important to making sure that the research we do is it's applicable to the people who will use it. And her comments about equity, I just want to amplify, because it's been said that if we simply got all of the treatments we now know work to everyone who needs them, we would see a dramatic drop in mortality without one more new discovery.
Mm, yeah.
So it's both pieces. It's finding new discoveries. That's so important. But it's also making sure the things we know work get to the people who need it. And Robin's really been at the forefront in making sure that we are all aware of that and that we are helping people get what they need.
Thank you so much, Robin. Appreciate your time today on Studio 2. We have some more comments, but before we get to those, I just wanted to address something that we did tease at the beginning of the show, Dr. DeMichel. There are more people being diagnosed
yes.
with breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw the statistics, my first thought was, oh, this is primarily because of advances in screening. But not so. There legitimately more people, especially younger people,
mm-hmm.
are being diagnosed with breast cancer. What's going on there?
Yeah, so this is a relatively recent piece of information that we've gotten from the epidemiologists who've told us that the rates of not just breast cancer, but 37 different cancers are rising in people between the ages of 20 and 40.
Wow.
We know this isn't just screening because we don't do screening in those patients. We don't even have good screening modalities that work. So these are people coming to medical attention because they have symptoms. We are seeing about a 1% increase every year in these age groups, which sounds small, but when you multiply that by our population, it actually is a really big number. There are a lot of researchers now trying to figure out what's going on. It doesn't appear that this is due to inherited genetics, right? We know that many young people do get cancers because they've inherited a genetic mutation that predisposes them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why genetic testing is important, remains very important. But we're also seeing a rise in people who have negative genetic testing.
Yeah.
They don't have a family history. This seems to be coming out of nowhere. We don't know what's causing it, and we need research to do this. And I want to just, you know, pick up on something that you said earlier, that publicly funded research through the NIH, through the National Cancer Institute. That is how we get the answers to these questions.
Margaret wants to know, by the way, is breast cancer research threatened by Trump's cutbacks? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is a really difficult time for researchers. We've already seen cuts, and we don't know what cuts are coming, but there's been discussion of a 40% reduction in the NIH budget, which is really, really going to set things back. So many of the advances that we have seen have happened in really because we have this ecosystem where the discoveries happen in the laboratories, in the universities. Those discoveries are then picked up by the pharmaceutical companies who devise a drug to attack that problem that then gets out into clinical trials, again, going back to the university and engaging patients to ultimately lead to an approved drug. This ecosystem needs publicly funded research. It needs the laboratory research. It needs the clinical trials of the new drugs for these advances to get out to patients. And so without that funding, there's so much of this that will come to a screeching halt.
That's often the first domino that gets you to the chain that you're talking about.
And it won't happen right away, right? But because there's a lot of research that's in the pipeline and coming out. But 5 or 10 years from now, when we don't have the next drugs, or even this generation of trainees who are not entering research because there isn't
Or they're leaving the country or going other places. Yeah,
we could lose a whole generation of really talented researchers. So there is clearly a threat.
Yeah. I want to bring in another caller. We have Anne from Haverford on the line. Anne, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hello. Yes, my comment was really about how far we've come. I'm 70 years old, and my mother in the 70s had breast cancer. And she had a mastectomy. There was no reconstruction. She felt totally mutilated at the time and had psychological problems subsequently. I had breast cancer in 2005. I had a lumpectomy. I found out later I had BRCA1. And after a long time, well, not a long time, but after a year and a half, of weighing everything up, decided to have a double mastectomy. And my daughter, unfortunately, is also BRCA1, and she also made the same decision. And even though the surgery is a difficult one, you know, we're both healthy and well. I actually subsequently, in more recent years, I had something called myelodysplasia, which leads to leukemia, and had to have stem cell transplants before it was dealt with. But basically, I am lucky. I had follow-up between my cancer that led to the discoveries about my genetic mutation, and it also meant that the follow-up that I had alerted me to the myelodysplasia and leukemia.
So the research has kept Anne alive. Thank you so much. That's Anne from Haverford. So many stories about people who have benefited from this cancer research. By the way, Dr. Monique Gary commented on Facebook. She says, I'm seeing more and more young women being diagnosed. There are no screening guidelines. We need to talk about what is happening in these communities and in our young girls. And we got to educate young women especially. And so I want to talk about environmental causes. Like, what should people be thinking about? Should young women be advocating more for screening? Because a lot of times it's not like Anne from Haverford, where this is a generational thing where, you know, my mom, my grandmom had it, I need to go get checked. But there are so many people who have no family history and they're seeing this. What should you be thinking about? How should you be advocating for yourself?
Yeah, so Dr. Gary is absolutely right. We are seeing this increase in women in young ages, and we don't have good screening modalities. Mammograms have trouble finding cancers in young women because their breasts are dense. So it really then becomes a matter of knowing what to look for now until we have better screening. We're starting a program at Penn for early onset breast cancer where we're educating young women and providers, clinicians who see them in OBGYN and student health and primary care practices, what do you look for? Because this is an area where for too long, there's a thought of, oh, you're 25, you're 30, you can't get breast cancer. And then symptoms are ignored until it's very advanced. So the first thing we need to do is raise awareness. That's something we're really focused on, is what do you look for and where do you go to get help and get somebody to look at what's going on? Do not ignore it. Do not let someone tell you you're too young to get breast cancer. Then we're going to have to figure out why this is happening. And, you know, I don't have any inside information on this, but you have to believe that it has something to do with our environment. And one thing people don't think about is that there's a lot of breast development that happens at puberty. And when the breasts are developing, there's the opportunity for DNA damage to happen. And so it could be even that some of the, you know, things that are just starting this process are things that girls are exposed to in their, you know, early teen years when they're going through puberty. So we're going to really need a strong effort to try to sort out what might be happening, whether this has to do with changes in hormones, that might be the case, whether it has something to do with environmental exposures. People have talked about microplastics, whether it has something to do with infectious agents. There's a long list of things that could be causing this. We don't know yet. So right now, what you need to do is be vigilant, mm-hmm. bring your problems to the attention of your doctor. Don't take no for an answer. Mm.
Yeah, advocate, yeah.
Speaking of vigilance, you know, our last caller, Ann, was talking about BRCA1. There's also BRCA2. These are genetic signifiers that greatly increase your likelihood of developing both breast and, I believe, ovarian cancer as well. And so Donna asks, why not give genetic testing to all women? A friend has stage 4 triple negative breast cancer. Turns out she had the gene. Her mother also tested positive but never got it. If she had the testing, she could have done preemptive surgery and wouldn't be fighting for her life right now. So are there things we could do with genetic screening that could really change the game for folks who have BRCA1, BRCA2 gene mutations?
Yeah, there's been a lot of change in the thinking on this over the years. And partially it was because initially the thought was, oh, this is affecting such a small proportion of the population. We shouldn't test everybody if only, you know, 5% of the patients right. have this. Well, it turns out that once we started doing all this testing, we realized that a much greater proportion, still somewhere in the 10 to 15% range, but that's appreciable. Mm-hmm. So there is a move to be much more aggressive about testing people, even without a family history, but just because they are under the age of 50. A lot of this has to do with also making sure that the insurers will pay for this testing. It's expensive, and so that can be a limitation. And then that doctors are aware of the testing so they can send it on the patients who need it. So this is, again, part of, you know, a lot of the work that's being done to really raise awareness about this in young people so that we know, do they carry one of these mutations? And just like the caller's daughter, you know, can do something about it preemptively and never have to get breast cancer.
By the way, we have Bonnie from Langhorne who asked, how does Dr. DeMichelle feel about breast thermographic imaging as a screening tool, especially when followed with an ultrasound? Your thoughts on that, and what exactly is that?
We need
that?
Some definition of terms here for that one. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the idea about screening the breast is to try to figure out if there's a way to differentiate rapidly dividing cancer cells from normal cells around it, right? And so there's lots of ways that we can do this. Heat is one of the things that could be able to tip us off that there's a cluster of cells that are dividing in a way that they shouldn't be. So this is one of a whole new set of ways that people are looking at trying to get around this problem with breast density to be able to find cancers that are in young women in these breasts so that we can do a better job of starting to screen.
Wow.
As we start to wrap up this conversation, mm-hmm. look, there are tremendous challenges on the research front. Obviously, there are these big questions about the environmental factors leading to increased prevalence of breast cancer. But amid all of that, Dr. DeMichelle, what gives you hope right now?
I think there's many, many reasons to be hopeful. Right now, we know that the majority of women who are diagnosed with breast cancer are going to be cured of their disease. That's the bottom line. Yeah. If we find it early, we have a better chance of curing it. And we have really wonderful treatments. And a lot of our research is focused on making those treatments less toxic and giving people fewer side effects. So it's a really hopeful time. I do think that we want to close that last gap so that we can get every patient who gets cancer, particularly breast cancer, to a point where they're able to be treated and never have to deal with it again. And then, of course, we would love to prevent it from ever happening. I think that's the next new frontier is prevention. And, you know, it's been hard to get people to take preventative strategies, but with new technologies like vaccines, I think there's a lot of hope for being able to prevent it from ever happening. Mm.
And by the way, we want to mention men as well, because men can get breast cancer. By the way, Leslie from Doylestown says, I too am a breast cancer survivor because it was caught so early. And she's now very diligent about making sure her female friends and acquaintances get regular screening as well.
Thank you so much, Dr. Angela DeMichelle, co-leader of the breast cancer program at the Abramson Cancer Center at the University of Pennsylvania. So appreciate your time today on Studio 2.
Well, thanks so much. It was an honor to be here.
Yes, and Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.